This episode is brought to you by Anytime Fitness. Forget dark alleys and cemeteries. For some, the gym is the scariest place of all, but it doesn't have to be. With a personalized plan and expert coaching, Anytime Fitness can help make the gym less frightening. Get more for your gym membership than machines. Get personalized support anytime, anywhere. Visit AnytimeFitness.com to try it for free today. Terms, conditions, and restrictions apply. See website for details.
It feels like we're all being told to go on this diet, take that supplement. Ozempic will give you depression, but you know what'll cure that? Weed. Or you could try to balance your hormones. At Science Versus, we're like,
what the f*** is going on?
Forget the crap online and listen to Science Versus. Just the facts. Oh, and a bunch of stupid jokes.
What is a ghost's favorite fruit? Booberries.
That's Science VS. New season out on Spotify soon.
On October 2nd, 1983, England was set ablaze with the revelation that a UFO had landed in Suffolk just 3 years prior.
An article in News of the World gave proof. There was a witness who claimed to have been there when it happened, and there was an official United States Air Force memo detailing the incident.
Under the pseudonym Art Wallace, former airman Larry Warren wrote that he had been part of the group that searched the Rendlesham Woods on December 28, 1980. He was 19 years old at the time.
As he and the other men arrived on the scene, they were witness to perhaps the most phenomenal event in human history.
A magnificent craft, unlike any Larry had ever seen, was sitting in the middle of a clearing. It shone with an incandescence that didn't seem possible.
Many Air Force personnel had already set up shop around the object, taking readings with equipment.
But in the center of it all, there were high-ranking colonels and generals surrounding the craft. Larry saw that they were communicating with someone. Or something.
As he squinted through the light, he saw that they were speaking with tiny, oddly shaped humanoids. The Air Force was making first contact with extraterrestrials. Are we alone? Have we been alone? Will we be alone? Stories of alien visitation have been ingrained in human history. Alien life may not be confirmed, but our obsession with it can't be ignored.
Welcome to Extraterrestrial, a Parcast original. I'm Tim.
And I'm Bill. Every Tuesday, we visit the marvelous and strange stories about our encounters with beings from another world.
We're aware that some of these tales may seem completely unbelievable. Others may seem all too real. But these stories shed light on human nature, human beliefs, and human psychology. And each story has garnered thousands, if not millions, of true believers.
And for that reason, we think they're worth exploring.
Today is our second episode on the Rendlesham Incident, one of the best documented UFO sightings in history. Though the evidence is compelling, there are many skeptics who believe they can provide a rational explanation for what happened that night in December 1980.
At Parcast, we're grateful for you, our listeners. You allow us to do what we love. Let us know how we're doing. Reach out on Facebook and Instagram at Parcast and Twitter at Parcast Network.
And if you enjoy today's episode, the best way to help us is to leave a 5-star review wherever you're listening. It really does help. We also now have merchandise. Head to parcast.com/merch for more information.
From the moment Larry Warren joined himself to the fabric of the Rendlesham narrative, he stood out as a controversial figure.
Colonel Charles Hault, who had been the chief officer during the second encounter, immediately wanted to distance himself from Larry's especially outlandish claims.
Colonel Hault had seen many strange things that night: lights in the sky, radiation burns on trees, and more. But he had never seen any actual aliens. He also personally debunked the idea that there was some large group of officers communicating with the aliens in the woods that night.
Halt and his small group of men were the only Air Force members on the scene.
Though Larry's story may have been exaggerated, it did bring the Rendlesham incident into the public light. Before this, other witnesses had been afraid to come forward. Some witnesses, like Sergeant Jim Peniston, admitted this and were grateful to Larry.
Peniston was later quoted as saying that the public reveal of the memo caught the Air Force with their pants down.
However, despite his gratitude to Larry, Peniston concurred with Halt that most of the article was bunk. Peniston saw the UFO, even touched it, but he never saw any aliens or evidence that there were members of the military communicating with them.
For his part, Larry believes that his experiences might be different than the others because of what was done to him by the OSI, the U.S. Air Force Office of Special Investigations.
According to later statements from Larry, not only was he silenced, he was brainwashed. Clandestine government agents took him to a secret area of the base where he and other members of the force were shown old movies of UFOs.
They were injected with drugs and told stories of what had happened on the base that night. Then they were forced to sign pre-written statements.
Larry thus suggested the more outlandish elements of his story, the aliens, the sinister government involvement, may have been planted by the government as a way of discrediting him.
Peniston and Halt both agreed that this was the case, that memories were planted in his head. If the OSI could turn a UFO sighting into a whole alien conspiracy, then they could ensure that no one would believe any of it.
This still begs the question as to why the Air Force would do such a thing. Were they just embarrassed that an unknown craft could get that close to an important military base? Was the UFO an experimental Air Force jet that needed to remain a secret? Ultimately, none of the men could say. They could only report on what they knew.
In 1984, Halt did just that when he shared his recording from the night of the 28th with researchers.
The tape is a fascinating piece of evidence for the UFO community. It proves that the men out in the forest that night did indeed see something.
Halt and others are heard explicitly referencing a light in the sky, a light that moves strangely, breaks into pieces, and shoots a beam down to the earth.
As evidence mounted, Peniston was transferred out of the country back to the States. In all likelihood, he was probably grateful to move on from the drama of Woodbridge and Rendlesham.
This is also what made these witnesses so compelling. Most of them acted as if they didn't want anything to do with UFOs.
Halt was once quoted as saying that the first thing he thought when he got back from the woods was, "I wish I had never gone out there."
As Peniston prepared to return to the U.S., he decided to bring the plaster casts with him. These were the molds he had taken of the strange impressions in the ground that he found on the 27th, the day after his sighting.
He felt they showed that something heavy and of intelligent design had landed in the forest that night. The ground was frozen, and so an animal or something similar wouldn't be strong enough to create an impression in the tundra.
Even weirder, the three circular impressions were the same size and formed a perfect triangle with 9-foot sides.
Peniston took 2 casts with him but ran out of room in his suitcase and had to put the other cast with some additional belongings in a shipping container.
He would forever regret this decision, as once Peniston and his family arrived in the U.S., the shipping container went mysteriously missing. It took 9 months for them to track it down and have it delivered.
Once they did get the container back and opened it, everything inside was as they had left it, except for the plaster cast.
It was, of course, missing.
The family's troubles didn't end there either. Peniston was reassigned to Grissom Air Force Base in Indiana. Once there, the family continually received threatening phone calls at their apartment.
Peniston, becoming increasingly paranoid, was motivated to search the house. He was shocked to find a listening device hidden on the premises. It was sensitive enough to pick up conversations throughout the apartment.
Similar things were happening to other witnesses. Burroughs reported that he was also being harassed. He came home one night to find that his personal files relating to the Rendlesham incident were stolen.
Public interest in the case only increased. A 1985 CNN report presented all of the evidence that had been made available thus far.
Multiple officers and airmen were interviewed, including Larry Warren. In 1986, the first book on the incident was published, Sky Crash, by researchers Brenda Butler, Dot Street, and Jenny Randles, allowed some, like Colonel Hult, to get their stories out in greater detail than ever before.
Even a decade after the initial sightings, the story was still being told and retold to the public. The first media depiction of the event came in 1991 in an episode of the long-running Unsolved Mysteries TV program.
Peniston, Burroughs, and Hult were all played by actors. The real Burroughs and Hult actually appeared in on-screen interviews. There's a lot of value in having on-screen testimony like this from firsthand witnesses. Other famous UFO cases, such as Roswell and the Hill abduction, happened too early for this level of documentation.
But this was also the point in time at which the Rendlesham incident begins to be mythologized, spun into an even more fantastical fable.
For example, Unsolved Mysteries depicts the beam of light that Hult describes on his tape as a distinct circular shaft of light that hits the ground literally inches away from Hult and his men. It looks like something out of a sci-fi movie.
The tape does not support this depiction. Hult mentions a beam of light coming down to the Earth from the light in the sky, but it's distant and on the horizon.
This may seem like a small quibble, but as we will soon see, the details matter. Skeptics were closing in, and to address their criticisms, the witnesses would need to keep their story straight.
This is in part why Peniston decided to undergo hypnosis in September 1994. Between Larry Warren's fantastical claims and the many exaggerated reports, he decided he wanted to both share his story and have the full details on what had happened to him.
Though he remembered his sighting well, what he didn't recall were the 45 minutes of time between the point that he touched the craft and the point that he and Burroughs found themselves suddenly at the edge of the clearing, looking up at the craft as it sped away.
Peniston had also been experiencing bad dreams, which reminded him of the famous Barney and Betty Hill abduction from decades earlier. In that case, hypnosis had helped the couple to recall what had happened to them and had alleviated some of their anxiety over the event.
But as we've mentioned many times before on this podcast, hypnosis, also called regression therapy, is a double-edged sword. Patients are just as likely to develop false memories as they are to uncover repressed memories. In fact, there's a lot of scientific evidence to suggest that the entire concept of repressed memory is bogus.
Peniston was about to learn this the hard way as he sat on his couch at home, ready to be hypnotized. What he learned next led to some of the most outlandish claims yet.
Up next, Peniston undergoes hypnosis and uncovers memories of the UFO's occupants.
This episode is brought to you by Anytime Fitness. Forget dark alleys and cemeteries. For some, the gym is the scariest place of all, but it doesn't have to be. With a personalized plan and expert coaching, Anytime Fitness can help make the gym less frightening. Get more for your gym membership than machines. Get personalized support anytime, anywhere. Visit AnytimeFitness.com to try it for free today. Terms, conditions, and restrictions apply. See website for details.
Now, back to our story.
In September 1994, Jim Peniston, formerly of Woodbridge Royal Air Force Base, agreed to undergo hypnosis in his home.
A trusted psychologist was hired to walk him through regression therapy, an attempt to uncover buried memories.
If this worked, he would remember the entirety of a UFO experience he had on December 26, 1980. Hopefully, he would recover 45 minutes of lost time.
Peniston was put under easily enough. He seemed especially susceptible to hypnosis. Within a few minutes, he was slumped back into his living room sofa, eyes clamped shut.
As the hypnotist walked him through the night of the 26th, Peniston seemed to recount the same details that he had revealed in the past. He and Burroughs saw a fast-moving light in the woods. As they got closer, they saw that it was a UFO.
Sitting on the sofa, Peniston literally acted out touching the UFO. He stuck his arms out, feeling the symbols etched into the craft. He smiled as he did this, apparently finding the experience pleasurable.
This brought him right up to the point where the lost time began, but rather than recall what happened in those 45 minutes, the hypnotized Peniston skipped right to the next part of the story that he could remember when he was standing at the edge of the clearing with Burroughs.
Ending the session, the psychologist suggested they schedule a second session to focus exclusively on the lost time. Maybe if they stepped away from the larger narrative, Peniston's subconscious would be forced to give up its secrets.
Peniston was moved by the tapes of the hypnosis session. To him, they confirmed that he had not imagined the UFO.
That didn't mean he wanted everyone to see him in this state. He kept the tapes to himself. Once again, Peniston proved to be a fairly believable UFO witness. Rather than try to profit or gain fame from his experience, he simply wanted to move on from it, to live a normal life.
However, the itch to uncover more of the truth proved too strong. What if he and the psychologist could really find out what happened in the missing 45 minutes?
He reached out and set another hypnosis session for November 1994. This time, they would begin by finishing the story, walking through the OSI interrogation and the aftermath.
Only then did the psychologist think they could comfortably try and re-examine previous parts of the story, chiefly the missing 45 minutes.
This next part of the hypnosis videos is not widely available, and much of what we know of it comes from secondhand descriptions in a 1997 Omni magazine article, as well as later interviews with Peniston.
According to these sources, as Peniston fell back into a hypnosis state and began to describe his interrogation by the OSI, astonishing new details emerged. He spoke of how the OSI agents actually left the interrogation room and were replaced by new, mysterious individuals, one American and one British.
He confirmed that they had indeed injected him with sodium pentothal, commonly known as truth serum. This alone was a shock.
But then, Peniston claimed that the agents were from a mysterious organization, DS-8.
This detail was especially revealing, as afterward, Peniston claimed he had no knowledge of what that meant. What was DS-8?
According to former British Ministry of Defense worker Nick Pope, DS-8 stands for Defense Secretariat 8. He calls this the civilian division within the Air Force that had the lead on UFO investigations.
If Peniston had no knowledge of this group, as few do, then his recalled memory would seem to suggest that the interrogation actually happened. The DS-8 detail couldn't have been pulled from his unconscious if he had never heard of them before.
As if this revelation wasn't significant enough, the psychologist decided it was now time to try and uncover what happened during the missing 45 minutes.
The hypnotized Peniston continued to be eerily calm. He was still seated on the sofa in his living room, eyes clamped shut, but able to answer anything the psychologist asked of him.
However, this segment of the hypnosis session becomes problematic. The psychologist asks potentially leading questions, such as whether Peniston saw any beings in the UFO.
Then, the hypnotized Peniston begins to make some outlandish claims. He says that he did make contact with beings on the UFO. He calls them travelers from our future.
He describes a dark future in which the Earth is desolate and mankind is sterile. With no other choice, they travel back in time to collect genetic material from their ancestors and reinvigorate the human race.
Peniston finishes by dramatically stating, "It's us. They're humans."
Upon watching this tape, a fully conscious Peniston had trouble believing what he was hearing.
He recalled the outlandish stories of Larry Warren and wondered if perhaps he had been drugged and given false memories, as Larry theorized had happened to him.
Peniston took this newfound information and finally shared his story in full with the aforementioned Omni magazine.
This was a popular science and science fiction magazine that was published between 1978 and 1997.
It was in that final year of publication that the Jim Peniston story ran. For the most part, it simply recounts his version of events. Significantly, Peniston mentions that he had a notebook during the UFO sighting with jotted down notes and images inside. This would come into play in the near future.
Toward the end of the piece, Omni interviews history professor and expert hypnotist David Jacobs, asking him to assess Peniston's hypnosis tapes.
Jacobs felt that while the majority of the sessions were genuine, the final moments, the ones in which Peniston speaks of time-traveling humans, are the result of channeling or dissociating.
Essentially, Jacobs believed that leading questions had brought Peniston into a state of free association, in which he pulled memories from other parts of his brain to answer the psychologist's questions.
Perhaps the most significant thing to come out of the article was that it further ignited the interests of several skeptics. This included astronomer Ian Ridpath, who had been working to debunk the Rendlesham story for years.
Ridpath first became interested in the case all the way back in 1983, when the News of the World article broke.
At the time, he had been working in astronomy for a decade. He was already the author of multiple planet and star guides. Much of his work centered around explaining the cosmos to the masses.
Ridpath found that a thorough understanding of the night sky and its myriad celestial objects helped to explain away outlandish stories of spaceships and aliens. This work naturally led him to debunk many UFO sightings.
With a wiry frame, thick glasses, and straight moppish hair, Ridpath was very similar to the young soldiers he now set out to disprove. Reporting for the BBC in October 1983, his first stop was to go to the Rendlesham Forest itself.
Once there, Ridpath interviewed forest caretaker Vince Thurkettle. The caretaker had a much simpler explanation for what the men saw in the forest: a lighthouse.
When walking through the forest at night and facing south, an eerie sight is visible through the dark woods, a solitary blinking light at eye level. But it isn't an alien ship or a ghost. It's the Orford Ness Lighthouse, a few miles away on the coast.
Ridpath and Thurkettle believed that the impressions in the dirt were nothing more than rabbit scratches. They also felt that the radiation burns on the trees could be ascribed to axe markings that the foresters made when marking trees to fell.
These explanations are too simplistic in some instances. They ignore details from the witnesses' stories.
But Ridpath advocates for a very objective approach to understanding the Rendlesham incident, one which eliminates any human bias or deception that may have resulted from years of media coverage.
This simply means that Ridpath takes only a few things as gospel: the HALT memo, the HALT tape, and the official witness statements that became publicly available in 1997. These were all signed by individuals such as John Burroughs, Ed Kabansag, and Charles HALT. Notably, Peniston's is unsigned.
To Ridpath's mind, these were trustworthy sources, as they were all created during or shortly after the event itself. They are firsthand accounts from the witnesses, without any UFO enthusiasts or sensationalist magazines influencing their memories.
In the HALT tape, HALT and his men are heard measuring the impressions, taking radiation readings of the tree markings, and then discovering the red light, which they follow. The light is said to split into multiple smaller lights and also to shoot a beam of sorts down to the ground.
The HALT memo provides a similar story and also summarizes the Peniston and Burroughs sighting from 2 days before. In the memo and in the witness statements from Burroughs and Peniston that describe the same events, the two soldiers are said to have entered the woods and followed a light that zigzagged through the trees.
Once they reached the light, they describe it as red, blue, and white, and say that it zipped back through the woods and out of their sight.
If this is all taken as the complete story, it is much easier to explain rationally. Both groups saw the blinking lighthouse through the trees. In the memo, the tape, and the statements, they all describe the light as blinking on and off at 5-second intervals.
The same time interval that it takes for the lighthouse to make one complete rotation.
In Ridpath's BBC report, the light shows up as yellow.
However, Ridpath claims that it can seem red or blue when viewed through foliage or different cloud cover. This is no different than how the moon occasionally appears orange or red.
And as clouds moved back and forth in front of the light, or the wind blew trees around in front of it, an optical illusion occurred in which the light seemed to move backward and forward.
A zigzag, if you will.
That leaves only the question of what Halt and his men described as the light breaking apart into smaller white lights and the beam shining down to the earth.
This would seem to be the hardest part of the story to debunk. What better evidence of a UFO could there be than a beam of light shining down onto the countryside?
And yet, even this did not impress Ridpath, for he believed that this most fantastical of details could be explained away with the most simple of explanations, the stars in the night sky. Next, we'll follow Ian Ridpath as he continues to debunk the Rendlesham incident. Then, we'll learn how the witnesses responded.
Now, back to the story.
Beginning in October 1983, astronomer and UFO skeptic Ian Ridpath undertook a decades-long journey to provide a scientific explanation for the Rendlesham incident of December 1980. One of the most difficult aspects of the case was explaining the beam of light that witnesses claimed emanated from the UFO.
This is where Ridpath's astronomy skills came into play. He believed that the men who had never been in the forest before were not used to the bright starlight of the night sky above the trees.
Imagine running beneath the canopy of the forest, chasing the lighthouse light through the trees, then emerging into the open field with the farmhouse. You look up, and for the first time, you notice the bright stars above.
Some of them seem impossibly bright, and they even blink slightly. You assume that the red lighthouse light you were just following has burst into a dozen smaller white lights.
Then you see the lighthouse blinking again on the horizon, and you're convinced that the sky is full of UFOs.
As the light refracts through clouds and fills your eyeballs with glowing light, it almost seems like the lighthouse light is shooting a beam down to the earth.
This is what Ian Ridpath imagines happened on December 26th and 28th in 1980. But of course, by taking only the first-hand sources, he is ignoring details brought up later by the witnesses.
Some of these added details are easy to ignore. From the beginning, Larry Warren was seen as an unreliable source. Some of the soldiers don't even believe he was in the forest on the 28th.
Therefore, his stories of seeing tiny men inside the UFO are considered by most to be fabrications or false memories planted in Larry's head by government agents trying to discredit the story.
This is one aspect of the Rendlesham incident that Ridpath doesn't address. The idea that the men were interrogated, drugged, and bullied into signing false witness statements. But he does point out that none of the men discussed these events until the story begins to get more press in the late 80s and early 90s.
By that point, you have John Burroughs on Unsolved Mysteries telling the story in a somewhat self-aggrandizing manner. He gives himself action movie-sounding lines, such as, "Who would want to come up to the base and light it up like a Christmas display?" referring to the lights he saw in the forest.
It is so hard to believe that he might then make up the third act, where he is interrogated by government agents.
Perhaps the most reliable witness was always Jim Peniston, who avoided the limelight until his 1997 Omni article, and even then only came out with his story because his hypnosis sessions had convinced him of what had happened.
Ridpath's theories don't do anything to debunk Peniston's claims that he actually touched the UFO, and that doing so caused him to lose time.
Again, he didn't publicly make this claim until over a decade after the incident. But if the men were all bullied into silence, then this makes sense. He may have been too afraid to come forward until the media coverage made the case more public.
It would seem that the discussion thus reaches an impasse. Peniston's story matches with Burroughs and Kabanseg's and is consistent with the imagery experienced by Halt 2 days later.
All of these men claimed they were cajoled into silence by the OSI or the Air Force in general. There are even additional soldiers from the base who claim the same thing.
And so, Ritpath's explanations work up to a point, but then we are left to wonder why so many men would push the same story of a government cover-up.
However, as time has progressed and Peniston, Halt, and others continue to participate in television documentaries and other interview formats, they have proven themselves to be prone to exaggeration.
A 2003 Sci-Fi Channel documentary provides the most comprehensive discussion of the case to date and even follows Peniston and Halt as they return to the forest and retrace their steps from all those years ago.
New details emerged, and in the process, the case was open to new criticisms. In 2010, Ridpath began to analyze some of the imagery from the 2003 documentary. The film marked the first time that the public saw Peniston's notebook, which up to that point had only been mentioned in articles.
One page that Ridpath singles out is dated as December 27, 1980, and below it is a list of times, 1220, 1230, etc., that seem to chronicle the UFO sighting as Peniston experiences it, moment to moment.
There are many obvious issues that Ridpath finds here. The sighting happened on December 26th, not the 27th. And the moments described on the page, seeing the UFO, touching it in the clearing, happened closer to 3 a.m., not midnight.
It's also strange that the times would be written in standard format rather than in military time. When Peniston was in the Air Force, he would have lived by the 24-hour clock, as does every soldier.
Ridpath thus contends that this notebook is a fabrication. He believes that it was created for the documentary and that Peniston never took any notes on the actual date of the sighting. Even more, Ridpath believes Peniston never actually got close to a UFO and touched it.
At first, this might seem rash. Even if the notebook was created as a prop for the documentary, that doesn't mean there isn't a real notebook in Peniston's possession or that his story isn't true.
However, for the first time, Peniston proved himself to be an unreliable witness. When Ridpath confronted him in an online forum in 2010, pointing out these discrepancies, Peniston tried to cover by saying that the numbers on the page are not dates and times, but rather binary code telepathically imparted to him by the UFO.
This is a narrative that he and Burroughs then went on to share in interviews with the German UFO magazine Exopolitik in 2011. Peniston claims that the day after he saw the UFO, on December 27, 1980, he was motivated to write out 14 pages of ones and zeros.
The numbers sprang forth from his mind, and only later did he learn that this was binary code. Peniston claims that this is why the notebook says the 27th rather than the 26th. The page shown in the documentary is from that second day.
For Ridpath, these claims hold little merit. The notebook page in question clearly shows a list of times with descriptions of the UFO sighting, not a string of binary code.
Why did Peniston never have the ones and zeros translated? If the inhabitants of the UFO thought it was important enough to telepathically impart this code to Peniston, wouldn't he make it his life's mission to find out what they were trying to tell him?
It would seem that Ridpath comes out victorious in this particular bout. And that's not the only new piece of evidence that Ridpath has brought to bear. A recent update on his website points out that a quote from Peniston's hypnosis session, "They are time travelers, they are us," comes verbatim from the 1993 TV movie Official Denial.
That film features a plot in which soldiers witness a UFO and learn that the inhabitants are humans from the future, attempting to harvest their ancestors' genetic material. Sound familiar?
RitPath isn't suggesting that Peniston watched the movie and then purposefully stole its narrative to spin his own UFO tale. Rather, he's pointing out how images and dialogue from that movie may have been pulled from Peniston's subconscious during his hypnosis session.
And though Peniston used to be willing to consider that maybe his memories were fallible, that perhaps they had been implanted in him by the government or were false memories from hypnosis, he now seems to have erased all doubt from his mind.
In the sci-fi documentary, he concludes his story by saying, "I don't believe in extraterrestrials. This is nothing more than us experiencing some sort of time travel."
It's unfortunate that Peniston and other witnesses don't approach their own experiences and investigations with a more scientific mindset. The Rendlesham incident features more firsthand evidence than any other UFO case. If the witnesses avoided bold claims of time travel and government conspiracy, it would be that much harder to doubt them.
But just as the Rendlesham incident benefits from a plethora of evidence, it also suffers from extensive scrutiny from skeptics. Ian Ridpath and Vince Thurkettle have each laid out a step-by-step case for what they think actually happened. Regardless of which side you take, the argument is likely to continue for years to come. Unlike many past cases, the major players are all still living.
While it may seem that we're thoroughly dismissing the story of the Rendlesham incident, there are several key pieces of evidence that remain interesting.
Examining these facts, we believe that we can rate the believability of the Rendlesham incident on a scale of 1 to 10.
The most impressive aspect of the case will always be the sheer volume and consistency of the witnesses. Half a dozen or more soldiers from the base all claim that they not only saw the UFO, but that they were bullied into silence by the Air Force.
Of course, they didn't claim this until much later when the case had become a media sensation. Their signed statements from the actual date of the sighting all say that they saw nothing more than a light in the sky.
The HALT tape remains an interesting artifact. It's perhaps the only known recording of a UFO sighting. The audio clearly chronicles HALT and his men as they experience things they can't explain.
Ridpath's explanation only goes so far here. The 5-second interval between light sightings is damning when considering that the lighthouse has the same time interval between rotations.
But trying to explain away the many strange light patterns that HALT and his team experienced as being nothing more than the lighthouse and some stars in the sky is almost as hard to believe as the UFO theory itself.
The lighthouse light strobes consistently. It isn't as erratic as the light that HALT and his men describe. On top of that, many of them actually mention the lighthouse in their witness statements. They were able to distinguish between that light and the light of the alleged UFO.
Whether the radiation burns were really just axe marks is impossible to know, given that we can't examine the trees today. Similarly, the impressions in the ground have been lost to time and so are impossible to rule on.
If they truly did form a perfect triangle, as Peniston claimed, then they may well have been much more than rabbit markings.
Peniston thus remains the key figure in this particular case. His interviews in the 90s, claiming that he touched the UFO, was drugged and threatened, and then harassed further, do seem credible.
However, that credibility has waned in recent years as he introduced new elements to the story, including time travelers and binary code. After studying many UFO cases, we know better than to trust the results of regression hypnosis, and Peniston should too.
With all of this in mind, we give this case a 6 out of 10 on the believability scale. We'd like to rate it higher, but some of these recent revelations give us serious doubts.
If nothing else, the Ridpath incident is a lesson in standing up for your convictions and not allowing yourself to be bullied or intimidated.
If the soldiers of Woodbridge Air Force Base had given the complete story from the beginning, if their witness statements included the full details of what they supposedly saw, then it would be impossible to doubt them. No other UFO case can claim so many witnesses.
Additionally, the Rendlesham incident is a lesson in not further sensationalizing a story to garner further interest. as the Rendlesham witnesses have participated in more and more interviews and full-on documentaries, their stories have only become more outlandish.
Is Rendlesham truly the British Roswell? We think so. Like Roswell, the narrative has spun out of control, but several interesting details linger, unable to be debunked entirely.
However, this is far from proof of extraterrestrial life. If there was a UFO of some kind in the forest in December 1980, no one knows for sure what was behind it, be it aliens, time travelers, or something else.
As always, the search for the truth continues.
Thanks for listening to our final episode on the Rendlesham incident. You can find all previous episodes of Extraterrestrial, as well as all of Parcast's other shows, on Spotify and anywhere else you listen to podcasts. New episodes come out every Tuesday.
Several of you have asked how to help us. If you enjoy the show, the best way to help is to leave a 5-star review.
And don't forget to follow us on Facebook and Instagram at Parcast and Twitter at Parcast Network. We'll see you next time.
Extraterrestrial was created by Max Cutler, is a production of Cutler Media, and is part of the Parcast Network. It's produced by Max and Ron Cutler, with sound design by Russell Nash. Production assistance by Ron Shapiro and Paul Mahler. Additional production assistance by Maggie Admire and Freddie Beckley. This episode of Extraterrestrial was written by Greg Castro and stars Bill Thomas and Tim Johnson.